This is a recording of the public hearing on Website and Internet Communications Improvement Initiative held by the Federal Election Commission on August 25th, 2009. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
My name is Steve Walther, and we're now convening an open session of the Federal Election Commission on August 25, 2009. And the purpose behind this particular session is to learn more about how we can improve our website and our internet communication. This is the second day of our hearings. We held a hearing on July 29th pursuant to a Federal Register notice that was entered, published on July 1st, 2009. The first day of our hearing was very helpful, and I believe each of the panelists have received a copy of the transcript of that, and we've made that part of our website, and along with the comments that we've received pursuant to the federal notice that was published on July 1st. With me on my right is Commissioner Cindy Bowerly. On my left is the Vice Chairman Matt Peterson. Far left, next left, is Commissioner Carolyn Hunter, and on the far left is Commissioner Don McGann. Also on the far left is Alec Palmer, our acting staff director, and on our right is Tommy Duncan, our general counsel for the commission. Commissioner Ellen Weintraub called and said she's running a little late, but to go ahead without her, and we'll have a transcript no matter what, and she'll be joining us fairly soon, I think. I want to thank everyone for coming. We're excited about hearing from you today. We're learning, as most people do. The more you learn, the more you realize you've got more to learn. And that's where we are today. We've learned a lot about the basics about ourselves as well as about other people. And I know today will result in the same benefit for us. First, I'd like to introduce our panelists. We have John DeBird from the Environmental Protection Agency. She's Chief of Policy and Program Management Branch. In her role as Chief, Mrs. Bird provides oversight on web governance activities, including infrastructure and web policy. She also serves as the National Web Infrastructure Manager for the EPA. In this role, she co-chairs the agency's Web Council with the EPA's Office of Public Affairs. The Web Council is responsible for overseeing the governance of the EPA Public Access website, and it promotes agency-wide standards for best web practices. In her role as Infrastructure Manager, Mrs. Bird coordinates the implementation and monitors the progress of the agency's web infrastructure projects, including a web content management system. Mrs. Bird has been working with the EPA's website since 1995. Next, in the middle, is Lisa Welchman from Welchman Pierpoint, who's founding partner. She is the founding partner of Welchman Pierpoint and a recognized leader in the area of information governance. Lisa leads consulting engagements with a combination of high-level strategic vision, clear understanding of the challenges of senior executives, and real-world problem solving. Lisa is a sought-after speaker for web management conferences and symposiums for insightful analysis of the complex problems faced by large-scale websites. Her past clients include the World Bank, U.S. Food and Drug Administration, USA.gov, the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard University, Clorox, Wells Fargo, FirstGov, the Social Security Administration, World Savings Bank, and Seattle Times Interactive, among others. And with that group of clients, we really are most appreciative of you being here today. Mrs. Doris has been, the next is Martha Doris from the General Services Administration, Acting Associate Administrator of the Office of Citizens Services and Communications. Ms. Doris is the, in her role as Acting Associate Administrator, Ms. Doris is responsible for setting the vision, strategy, and operational direction of the communications program. She oversees the progress in citizen outreach, intergovernmental solutions, and provides assistance to other federal agencies in their service delivery. Ms. Doris is also responsible for established partnerships with stakeholders, including the Office of Management and Budget, state and local government agencies, federal e-government program managers, and other GSA colleagues. Mrs. Doris has been with the GSA since 1992. So with that introduction, We're very pleased and honored to have you here today, and I would like to begin with Ms. Bird.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to share with you the web governance model that EPA has adopted as you continue on your quest to improve your website. I will give you a little bit of background about where we have been, how we got to where we are, and lessons learned, and what we might do differently in the future. Our web governance model is a formal structure with policy, procedures, standards, and guidance. It is developed within the framework of the CIO of our agency, the CIO is the one that is officially signing all the policies. It provides accountability for content and infrastructure. So I want to give you a little bit of background about how we got to where we are. EPA's website was established in 1994, and in 1995, EPA developed the first look and feel to their website, and that's when I became involved in the web. And so from 94 to 95, we grew up a little bit. The website was managed by the predecessor organization to our current Office of Environmental Information. It was still basically the CIO's organization. In 1996, recognizing that we had many people working on the web in the agency, the EPA established a web work group. Basically, this is a community of people that work on the web. They may be content developers, or they may be technical web developers, programmers. But this community consists of about 400 people across the agency. And we established this web work group to provide us with advice and to help facilitate communications concerning any web issues. In the early 2000s, however, as we all know, the web became the primary communication mechanism for most agencies. And the Office of Public Affairs became more and more involved in our web activities, in using the website, in providing content, and generally helping set direction of where the web was going. There was a little bit of tension between the two offices, and I think part of that was just not having clear understanding of the roles and responsibilities between the two and how we were going to operate. So in 2004, a task force was formed that consisted of senior managers across the agency, as well as the chair of the web work group, and they decided upon a web governance model for the agency. These recommendations were made to the administrator at the time, Michael Levitt, and Michael Levitt then in December of 2004 issued a memo to establish the Web Council. The Web Council consists of two representatives, one content and one infrastructure manager from each AA ship and region of the EPA. We have 13 program offices and we have 10 regions. So 23 times 2 is 46. It's a pretty big body. It's co-chaired by the Office of Public Affairs, National Content Manager, and the Office of Environmental Information's National Web Infrastructure Manager. One of the things we did do relatively quickly was to adopt deputies so that we could have assistance in co-chairing and helping to staff the Web Council. The Web Council recommends web policy, approves content and technology procedures, standards and guidance, promotes web consistency, quality, and unity of message in their respective organizations. The Web Council convened their first meeting in the spring of 2005. They created a charter, decided to meet semi-annually face-to-face, and this is bringing people together all across the agency. And then we conduct a monthly teleconference. And I will say that that doesn't happen every month. If we really don't have something to meet about, we don't have a teleconference. But we do have them most months. The council was successful in developing and recommending an overarching web policy for the agency. And the name of that policy is Web Government and Management. The website on the EPA is called Web Governance, and I believe Stacy may have given you all the URL, but it's epa.gov/webgovernance, and all of our documents are on that website, the charter, the initial charge memos, and the policies and procedures are there, as well as the contact information for all of the Web Council members. We also developed a set of procedures that are under the policy. These procedures speak to things like complying with EPA.gov look and feel, ensuring access to EPA information on EPA servers, and also external links. The Web Council was very productive the first 2 years. Building this policy framework took a lot of time, and it, I think, made a difference. It was very good to have something to point to, especially in codifying the roles and responsibilities of the Office of Public Affairs and the Office of Environmental Information, and explaining just who was going to do what and how we were going to operate. It also codified a set of principles of how we were going to operate the EPA. So, looking at this 4 years later, it's time to reflect to see what has worked, what's still relevant, what lessons we've learned, and what we should do in the future. Having a governance body works. Whether it needs to be 46 people, I'm not sure. It helps discuss and recommend the direction and resolution of many web issues. And as I already said, establishing that policy framework really did make a difference for us, particularly having the procedures and the standards and the guidelines so that people would know where to turn to as you have new people coming on board. And the Office of Public Affairs and the Office of Environmental Information work well together, and we don't have that tension anymore. And I think that has been very, very gratifying. But what we've learned is that when you have a web governance body, it's really important to have the right level of people on it. We started out with higher level people, and they soon delegated down. And so we have a very mix of levels of management. We have an office director. We have branch chiefs. We have staffers. When you start talking about resources and FTEs, it's important that you have somebody at the table that can speak to that and make the decisions for their agency, I mean for their organization. The other thing that we've discovered is not all people that are on the council are comfortable or have the ear of the person they should have the ear to speak to about important decisions. And even though we try to remind them and help them in that aspect, we have not been able to really resolve that issue. It's important to communicate on at all levels, though, even if you do have the right people at the table. Having the web work group is also a valuable organization to us because they are the people that are actually putting up the pages, and it's good to hear their input. They're often the people that research and come up with innovative ways to do things and come to us and recommend new products and services. It is also very important to have management at the highest level supportive of the organization. And we had that at the beginning, and we still have it at the highest levels in the Office of Public Affairs and in the Office of Environmental Information. The EPA has several governance bodies. One of them is the Quality Information Council. Over the years, there's been a disconnect between the Web Council and the Quality Information Council. It is very important that any governance bodies that exist on related issues connect and continue to have liaisons and talk. The other issue with 46 people on a web council, the turnover is a little bit greater than what you might have with a smaller body, and often starting over is not easy. And I wouldn't say that we actually start over, but when a new person comes on board, you do have to bring them up to speed. And sometimes decisions that we've already made, we have to go back to why we are where we are, and if we can maybe be flexible and adapt, that's one thing. But sometimes when you're in the middle of doing a migration, you have to go forward. And the other thing that I think is really important is for us to periodically review our charge memos, really find out what we were set up to do, and to see if we're fulfilling that mission. And if we're not, to make the necessary adaptions and be flexible and modify how we are organized. So that brings us to relevance. The EPA is currently looking at its web governance structure. We are migrating to a web content management system. But more than migrating to a web content management system, we're looking at our website and looking at how we can truly integrate our website. We have 500,000 pages. We have every office has their own, basically, home page, and we want it to be. And while we think that we have one look and feel, not so much anymore, one agency, one voice, we could be better integrated. And we truly want to achieve that goal. And we've had that goal since 1998. And we knew it would take us a while to get from where we were to where we want to be. And I would say we're somewhere at about 60%. And I think that the new tool is going to enable us to do the rest. But the other part is going to be political will. And in looking at the political will and the organizational structure, I think that we are going to have to create something that is more like an editorial board and be a smaller group with a little bit more discipline, and engage the work group for more of the standards and the issues that the managers might not want to take time to do, like when we have to decide what boxes and bullets we need on our website. With that, I would be happy to take any questions that you might have, share with you further about our experience.
Thank you very much. I'm not sure whether we have questions now or whether we will continue, but I know that I certainly have some questions, and I'm sure all of us would. But maybe let's continue with some of the other comments and then come back, and let's do some questions right now. Okay, we'll go ahead and Ms. Welshman.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you so much for inviting me to be here. This is really exciting for me. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my background just because I'm not within the federal government, never have been, and I do something a little bit unusual. My firm helps people work specifically with web governance and web team formation problems. So not implementing anything, not designing anything. So we're all about the web and all around technology and understand those things, but we're not putting our hands on it. My personal background stems from managing the web publishing infrastructure at Cisco Systems during the internet boom. And when I was there, I was very fortunate enough to, in 1996, which I think is the same year you all started your web presence, I was really the first big giant website that I had worked on, and it had hundreds of thousands of pages at that time. And so I was very fortunate to be able to see firsthand, hands-on, what it means to manage a web presence of that size that was global in scope and had a lot of interactivity. I also, and didn't really realize this till about a month ago, took something for granted, and that was that the person in the C-suite in charge, the CEO, was web-enabled and got the web. Because it was Cisco Systems, everyone there had to take networking classes. Everyone was all about the internet. Everyone was all about the web, and we were really pushing it. And I really took for granted that John Chambers really understood how to use the internet and how the whole e-commerce push that Cisco was so famous for. And so I left in 1999 to start consulting in this space, at first helping people with content management system technologies, but very shortly thereafter realizing that most people couldn't effectively implement those technologies or support those technologies because basically they had governance problems. I think a lot of people use the expression wild west to describe what's going on most web presences and the way that they're produced, there's very few controls put in place. And so I spend a lot of time trying to not hinder creativity and expression and freedom of speech, but enable it through establishment of standards. So that's a specific space that I work in. And I'm very unweb-enabled today. I have wonderful little index cards that I've never gotten away from since college. So I've got a few remarks to make, just to give you some structure around them. I'm going to tell you historically what I've seen a lot in the federal sector, and we've worked with a lot of large federal agencies and continue to do so, and just some general trends that we've seen. And then what I'm hoping to do is to put the commission more on the hook than you've already put yourself with these wonderful public hearings. The fact that we're having these at all is a strong indication of engagement at the senior level of the organization. And I've got to tell you, that's usually not the case in the federal sector, and it's can sometimes be a serious problem. So I have some specific tasks that I would recommend that I think you all could do specifically. So let me talk about the three things first that I see mostly happening. The first one of them is a compression of web strategy, web governance, and web execution. And that historically makes a lot of sense. When you think about even 10 or, I guess we can say, commercial web hit in 1993, so I could say 10 or 15 years ago, there was maybe one person in the organization who was kind of geeking out over things. And little by little, that grew and grew and grew. And we all know that organic growth story. Right. So, but at this one time, there was this person called the webmaster, and you might still have some of those in your organization. And that webmaster did everything. Right. They sort of figured out what was going to go on the web. They figured out the rules around it, and they also did it. Right. So that, in my mind, meant that they were doing strategy, governance, that's the rules part, and then the execution part is the getting it done part. And so that's kind of the history of how we all work in the World Wide Web and what we're used to, and it's the culture. And it's also one of the major culprits in why we can't do any more sophisticated work, some of the sophisticated work that organizations would like to do. So this compression, I think there needs to be a separation and of web strategy, and that needs to be addressed separately, web governance addressed separately, and then the tasks that you use, the actual execution of the work done separately. I'll talk about that a little bit more. The second one that I see, and I know when I went and listened to and read the hearings that went on, I think, last month, I think it was a gentleman from the Sunlight Foundation mentioned the IT marketing communications battle over ownership of the web presence. That's really a classic dynamic, and it continues. It's a little bit frustrating for me because, from my view, the web presence is owned by the organization. It's not owned by the IT group or owned by the marketing communications group. The web presence is really a digital manifestation of your organization and should functionally act the way that you act, except online. So that means that everyone's got to be involved in the process. It's not something that happens off in this little siloed corner, whether it be IT, communications and marketing, or both of them combined. That's been a dynamic that I saw as early as when I was doing my work at Cisco. I wrote a paper on this in 2001. I think I called it Commercial Web, the Marriage of Marketing and IT. And it was all about this battle of back and forth. So that's common and needs to be settled down. And then the third piece really is just a product of the other two and an observation, which is that I think organizations are focusing so much on the production of a web presence or website, whatever you want to call it, that they're missing the opportunity to actually web-enable the entire organization. And when you look at the demographic and the transition between, I think, technically part of the digital immigrant generation, and my son, who's 14 years old, is a digital native, right? So as these digital natives start to move more and more into the workplace, I think their tolerance level and the citizens' tolerance level and everyone's tolerance level for unweb-enabled types of activities is going to, change somewhat. And so I think that's truly a missed opportunity, and it's, I think it's, everyone knows that the internet and the World Wide Web as a service is revolutionary, but I think that in the federal sector and in general, most people have not reacted to it as if it were revolutionary. They're trying to make a website, do these very, very tactical things and not thinking about how do we really need to fundamentally change the organization given the existence of the World Wide Web. So those are my three observations that I see going along a lot in the federal sector. So let me talk. I have three things, and I'll try to be brief about them, that I think that would be kind of calls to action. And one of them would be directly at people at your level, which is to have structured and persistent and clear leadership from the commission about what needs to get done. And that can manifest itself very easily. I think people at a senior level frequently distance themselves from the web because they see it as technical or something beyond their understanding. And certainly the execution and creation and the tactics of creating a web presence should be and are. But I think the strategizing about it and the way that that can manifest it is through a set of guiding principles that you can provide the organization about how the web is actually going to work in your organization and how you're going to use it. How is it going to be used to meet the mission? Not at a technical level, but at a very, very strategic level. Something that could be on one or two pieces of paper and has very visionary in tone, but really sets the standard. The other second piece is, I think, much more difficult, and it's one that I see missing in most federal agencies, and that's a really strong formalization of authority. Because the web grew organically, frequently there was no top-down surveying and analysis of what it means to have a web presence and what you need to do to get it done in your organization. So frequently folks are working on the site and it's collateral duty. Many people have been working on websites for 10 years and it's nowhere in their job description. They're not really evaluated against that. And while that may seem like a small thing, when you think about motivation and why people work and they're being evaluated based on these what's in their job description, the web's got nothing to do with it. I think that's very, very important, and it's important that it come from this level. There's three types of formalization of authority. One of them has to do with expressing who's going to be the top-level governing authority. So if you had some sort of policy council, who would be chairing that, and where would that sit? The other piece is really the execution tier, and that's really saying, who's going to actually make our web presence? Who's in charge of that, and properly staffing them and properly funding them? That's a hard choice because usually, you know, I'm a proponent of a standalone web team, completely integrated resources, right? All the technical resources that you need as well as the communications resource. That's hearsay in the federal government because IT and those two pieces are two arms that just not only might be fighting with each other but don't work well together. But when you think about what it takes to build a web presence, you need those two sets aligned. So barring that, at least some expression of how those folks are going to work together and some a mandate about that. And the other piece, and I think this one is really key and frequently does not come up, and that's about key performance indicators. What are you as senior individuals expecting the web presence and the use of internet technology to provide to the organization? And that gives people something to execute against particular goals. If you don't do that, what you'll have are people sort of willy-nilly, second-guessing, implementing what they want, and you get this kind of mouse-shaped, not working altogether web presence. So the second one, and this is great follow-up with what John DeBird was saying here, which is the recommendation to establish some formalized governance for any organization, but specifically with you all in mind. And there's three components of that. One is the expression of a web governance framework through a charter. And that's really formally specifying who has input and who makes decisions about the web in this organization. And how do the decisions get made? When there are exceptions made, how does that roll? I'm sure that sort of thing works very well in your type of culture. But most organizations don't have a web governance charter, and it's not very clear. And so what happens at a project-by-project basis, people fight, right? Should we put this application up? It becomes a battle of wills, right? Because it's not been specified who gets to make decisions about editorial matters, who gets to make decisions about which applications get implemented. These sorts of things can be decided once instead of every single time you have a project. The second piece of the web governance has to do with policy setting. And this is part of there's compression even within the web governance piece, which is people frequently compress policies and standards together. The policy-making function I see is a fairly senior one, and it's about protecting the organization from liability risk, making sure you're meeting the mission. There are other types of things like right now, social media policy. They're largely ignored things in the web world and internet, as it has to do with email, such as records management, records retention. Those sorts of things are very, very big policy decision. Standards are about how are we going to actually make the web presence? Is it XML? What color font? How many? Is it natural language? Or are we writing for the fifth grade? Are we writing for college level, grad level? What are we doing? There's all sorts of standards, and there's a lot of those, far fewer policies. And I think that those need to be created by two different groups of people because there's two different sets of interest. One's protecting the organization and its mission, and the other set is setting standards to execute against. So, and then there's the standards-making bodies, and I just talked about those. Those are a different group of people, and I always like to point out, and I think I said earlier, that web people frequently perceive standard as being something that keeps them from being creative, but the reality is that standards enable collaboration. Web 2.0 and social media is all about standards. Look at Wikipedia. You can't just put up any kind of page you want, and it's heavily monitored. Look at blogs. What can you really do on a blog? You can write an entry, you can comment. If you've got some widgets to it, you can send things to people, but it's a very controlled environment. There's a lot of freedom of speech and expression involved, which is great, but it's very, very standards driven. And then the last and short piece is making sure that you have a well-formed and enabled web team. And that would mean making sure that you take care of the programmatic administrative component out of it, as well as the product management. Right now, that's a little shaky in most organizations. You have a bunch of web people running around. If you're lucky, you've got someone at the program level who can go get you money when they need to or whatever. But there's really not this definitive understanding that, you know, there's measuring how effective we are as programmatic duty as opposed to looking at the website and deciding it how it should be as more of a product management piece. So that's usually something that's not working particularly well as it may be. And so my last thing before I stop talking will be is that I think this process is really wonderful, but I would also urge you to have the same process internally with the folks who work on your web presence and others who interact, because my experience has been that you have a lot of solutions in your organization, but they're either embedded way down at levels with people who are either afraid to speak or too timid, it's not in their personality, but to really have this open conversation, because those folks are also aware of your internal processes and how the dynamics of your organization work in a way that somebody from the outside just couldn't know. And they're frequently very, very brilliant solutions embedded in your organization, and they just haven't had an opportunity to surface. So thank you.
Thank you very much. That was very great, interesting. Ms. Doris?
Well, thank you, Chairman, for the opportunity to be here today and share our story in the Office of Citizen Services within GSA with your team here. Just a little history. We were created in June of 2002 by integrating all of the citizen service delivery channels within GSA. So we had, in one organization, we had firstgov.gov, which was the main federal portal at that time. We had a contact center that had been in place for years. We answered the telephone number 1-800-FED-INFO for citizens to call and get information about the government. And we've been delivering print publications from our distribution center in Pueblo, Colorado, which you've probably heard about, for over 30 years. So we have a wealth of knowledge in our office of people who've been dealing with consumers and with the public for, you know, 30, 35 years. And so we were able to actually leverage the lessons learned and the way that they had been working with the public into this electronic age. I always say, you know, your work is never done. I mean, if you look at the citizens change, the demographics change, the technology changes, they're influenced significantly by what experiences that they're having in the private sector and dealing with public websites or commercial websites. So your work is really never done. This is an ongoing process. You know, it's in the history of USA.gov, for example, which we renamed from firstgov.gov, which would be one lesson learned right there, is nobody knew what firstgov.gov was. I mean, we did lots of testing and found out that people thought it was governor's offices and banks. And so when we renamed it to USA.gov, the name recognition and the traffic went up tremendously. So something as simple as what you call your site is very important. But in the history of it, we launched it back in September of 2000. It's gone through several redesigns, one where we wanted to go three clicks to service. We renamed it about 2 years ago. We've changed recently to a new infrastructure, redesigned it again about a year ago. I'm not sure I will ever go through a major total redesign again personally. What we will do is probably do incremental improvements to the site over time, because the big leap in terms of a huge total redesign is very difficult. We moved to the cloud back in May of this year, and right now, we're looking at what is the next generation of search, government-wide search. We're moving our content management system right now. We've just selected a new content management system, and we'll be moving that. So it's a continual, the pieces are always moving, a million miles an hour. And if you've heard about the disconnect between content and the infrastructure, I happen to have both the content and infrastructure groups in my own office. So I'm the referee. One's left brain, one's right brain. One's IT focused, one's marketing and communications focused. So it's a natural dissension between the two types of thinking, and it used to really bother me until I heard the CTO from Google talk about how having people with different opinions, at the end you come out with the best solution. And so now I kind of embrace it and let them kind of work it out, and we always end up, I think, with the better solution at the end, but creating a safe environment where they can actually be respectful and talk about the ways that they see things a little differently. But to go back, our goal in our office is to provide timely, accurate, and consistent information to the public, regardless of the channel that they want to use. So whether they're coming to us via the internet, so we have the USA.gov. We have a Spanish version of that, GobiernoUSA.gov. We have about a whole family of consumer websites that we manage, MyMoney.gov, Consumidor.gov, ConsumerAction.gov. We're the ones that create the Consumer Action Handbook, so that when that's handed out, so that when consumers want to fight things around, in different products, that this gives them a place to go. So that's on the internet side. We've also gotten heavily involved in the new media area. So, whether we're getting information out, we've come to the conclusion that it doesn't really, we're not trying to get people just to come to our website. We're trying to get the information to the people who need the information. And if that means that we send it out through, intermediaries, we started developing like syndicating content and creating widgets and pushing those out to other areas. So we're really more about getting that information out. Our office is very unique in that by bringing all of these different channels together to serve the public, we're able to, in almost every national emergency or situation, we have been involved in providing information to the public, whether it's the bombing in Mumbai, whether it's London bombing, tsunamis, the VA laptop, when that was stolen, we put a contact center in place for VA. Wildfires, you name it, we usually have some role in getting the information out. So just to give you an example of how all this works together, we do our direct service through these sites, but we also, our job is to help other agencies improve the information and the way that they deliver service to the consumer or the public. So we do things like we have a contract in place for contact center services. So agencies use our contract to set up a contact center. We really leverage networks across the government. One of our largest networks is the web managers. And so we run a council of 1,500 web managers that's basically enabled through a new Facebook-like product called Your Membership. But that's how they share information across these 1,500 web managers. If they have a question, they go on the site and are able to get information from other people in the same situation that they're in. We run an annual conference where we bring them together. This year, it was like a revolution. I mean, it was standing room only. You would have thought, that we were selling something there, giving something away. It was amazing to see 500 web managers in one room with the passion that they have for what they want to get done. So we bring all of them together, and that's a very mature network from our standpoint. We recently brought together contact center leaders from across the government, and we're creating a citizen services council of people at a senior level within an agency so that we can start looking across the whole government and how do you measure the services that you're delivering to the public. We run Web Manager University, so we do absolutely low-cost training that agencies, I mean, there's webinars, there's, you know, in-classroom training. They range from $30 to about $200 for a day or two training. This covers our cost with a little bit of overhead so that we can put on our annual one-day conference or two-day conference for the web managers. We're an appropriated organization, so the money that we're not trying to make money. We don't put overhead on anything that we do. And so this is a perfect opportunity and right in line with the mission that we do. We also do a lot with sharing best practices. A website that you may be familiar with, webcontent.gov, gives you a lot of information. What policies and procedures do you need to look at? What's a checklist of things you should look at? How do you optimize your site for search engines? How do you process that you go through for knowing your customer? So there's a lot of best practices on that website. And then in the new media area, this is really one of our growing areas in terms of best practices and creating public dialogues and how do you, what are the best ways to do it. And we're creating a platform where all agencies will be able to use a set of common tools to run different kinds of citizen engagement opportunities. So in dialogues, we've also negotiated terms of service agreements with about 25 providers so that, you know, your general counsel doesn't have to start from scratch. If you want to do an agreement, a terms of service agreement for Facebook or YouTube, you can go on webcontent.gov, pull down the terms of service agreement that we did for GSA, and that can be used as the template that you use to negotiate with them, because the providers didn't want to negotiate separate agreements with all agencies. And so we've gone through and negotiated and we brought other agencies' general counsels in when we did that so that they're, you know, I wouldn't say they're going to be 100% all the time, but they're probably going to be 90 or 95% because we've had multiple agencies involved in that. We're also, our website, citizenservices.gov, which we are actually in the process of redesigning ourselves, is where all of the information that's available for other agencies to use in this space, in the citizen services space. We're doing research around what citizens want from government, how they want it from government, and that will be located there. So that kind of gives you, you know, perspective of we provide direct service, but we're also in the business of helping other agencies. And when you have a national disaster like Katrina, what we did was we got the information, what is the citizen asking on the phone, and we fed that into the Web Managers Council and the web managers across different agencies, and then they created lanes so that we made sure to ensure which content went on which websites around the government, and there were daily calls to make sure that you were feeding in what the citizens were asking, and so we could make it available online. So that's sort of a little bit of history and background about what we do. I have some, you know, basic best practices that I would share with you that we've learned. Again, every agency goes through their own struggles and their own decisions as you deal with websites, and we're at a pivotal point with USA.gov where we're starting to look at what is the future of a website. Is it more user-generated content right now? It's a portal that links to all other agencies. You know, we do a lot of day-to-day, you know, maintenance and management of that, making sure we don't have broken links and all the day-to-day stuff. But strategically, what will websites look like in the next couple of years? I think it's really important. The first thing I would say is to know your customer. You know, we have a customer, whether it's USA.gov or Gobierno, they're both two different customer bases. You've got the public and the citizens on one side, and then you've got mostly the Spanish-speaking population, which there's about 30 million that speak Spanish in their home, as a part of the other the customer of the Gobierno USA.gov. We've got web managers who are the customers of webcontent.gov, and we've got the agencies, who are the customers of citizenservices.gov. So understanding and knowing the customer and what it is that they want is really one of the most critical things. I mean, if you think about any product that any organization is creating, knowing those expectations is probably the most important thing. Also knowing what are the top things that your customer comes to your website for. We're very big in our office about pushing top tasks. So, you know, many agencies have websites where it's the secretary of whatever's picture on the front page with a message from them. And that's not why people are coming to that website for the most part. They have certain business functions and reasons that they're coming to your agency to conduct. And being able to put those things on the front page and they're easily found and accessible and easy to understand, it's very simple to make that happen. It's just knowing what those are. The next thing I would talk about is providing mechanisms for two-way dialogues. You know, whether it's just a contact us, whether there's ways for people to give feedback. The new media stuff is really opening that world up, but being able to get ongoing feedback. We actually do web chat through our contact center. So from USA.gov, you can enter into a live web chat that's answered by our contact center. So that's another way that we actually do that. And Lisa mentioned some of the policies. I mean, there's a lot of policies around, you know, accessibility, security, privacy, you know, what kind of information is available through your site, and making sure that all those things are protected, because the citizen does have high expectations of the government and how we protect their personal information. And then, you know, the big thing that people really think about is just the content. And I mentioned top tasks. We know that about 50% of the people search and about 50% navigate, although I think search is becoming more and more popular over time. So how do you create a robust search capability so that the citizen, your information is transparent, the data is accessible, it's structured in a way that search engines can find it, that you have sitemaps so that search engines can find that as well. So making sure that your information is accessible. Another thing we push, best practice, plain language. You know, what level are you writing for? And we have the problem in GSA where we do fleet management. Now, not many people know what fleet management is, and it's around cars. But, you know, people think it's aircraft. We fought with our own GSA.gov people about how do you put the information on GSA.gov so that the average citizen understands that when you talk about fleet, you're really talking about cars. Then you get into, is it cars or automobiles? And so, you know, figuring out the way to write this so that it's understood by the most people. The other thing, don't duplicate existing information. If you need to, you know, link to other sites, we're definitely a site of linking to other people. And one of our next steps is how do we pull information from a lot of other agency sites, mash it up together, and present a different picture to the citizen so that the value that we add could be around, you know, automobiles and bringing information in on fuel safety and, you know, our fuel economy and then the safety ratings and pulling all that together and presenting it. Or if we have a national disaster, we will pull together information from federal, state, and local governments about resources that are available to the citizen and pull it together so it's easy for the citizen to find information. Clearly displaying your agency's name, you know, making sure that that's done, your URL. And the other, by URL, I meant, you know, exactly what the name is, as I mentioned before with USA.gov. Another thing we push is usability testing. When we last redesigned USA.gov, we did 3 rounds of usability testing. We tested the existing design. We did a preliminary design and did usability testing. And then we tested the final design to make sure, you know, is the search box long enough? And does it, you know, is it in the center of the page versus on the edge of the page? So those rounds of usability testing, while it drags out the schedule a little and it can be a little more expensive, we found to be very worth the time and effort that we went into. There are classes at Webmanager University on usability testing. So if you, you know, we have a lot of expertise internally on usability testing. I mentioned search engine optimization. The other thing is, you know, continual assessment of the content that you have and going even into the commercial search engines and finding out what are people searching for to make sure that you're constantly updating your site with the information that the public is looking for and keeping the content current. So all of those things are around just around your content. The next thing is around the use of new media. We do a lot of that. For the inauguration, what we did was we got press passes. We put people on the ground, and we actually gave the public a bird's eye view of being at a lot of the inaugural events. They did Twitter feeds. We updated the Facebook page. So the whole time, all of that was being fed into a blog that we have called govgab.gov, and that's basically a daily entry of everyday life situations so that the public, they don't quite understand all the government information that affects them every day, but it could be a story about it's fall and you want to take a trip to the country and you want to get apples. I mean, it could be around farmers markets that are listed by government agencies and USDA, organic foods. I mean, food pyramid, nutrition, all of this is government information that we kind of, you know, integrate into a blog entry that we put out every day, and that's govgab.gov. So we've implemented RSS feeds, email alerts, widgets and gadgets. You can see a library of all the government podcasts from USA.gov, and then the stuff that we did with the inauguration. We also did a photo contest, wasn't a contest, a photo gallery during the 4th of July where people submitted their photos, and we had kind of the Americana slideshow of photos, which went on Flickr but was accessible through USA.gov for a week or two around the 4th of July. So some of that is around just making it a little bit fun and engaging the public, but some of it is there's a line for me around too much of the marketing and fluff piece and not enough about, you know, the actual business of the agency. But some of it is really good to drive traffic and get people so that they actually know your website. We have a USA.gov and Gobierno USA.gov Facebook page that you can become a fan of. And we do daily feeds so that it gets the information out to the different demographic of people that are using Facebook. Lastly, I'll talk a little bit about the infrastructure. I said we moved to the cloud. I mean, really, you're looking for a secure, scalable, flexible, you know, and robust infrastructure. We saved about 90% of our infrastructure costs by moving from our old architecture into the cloud infrastructure. And we're still in the process of getting our staff up to speed in terms of being able to manage the site from an infrastructure standpoint themselves. But we've been sidetracked with a lot of new administration priorities, so that's been part of the holdup. And I think I will stop there so you can ask some questions. I mean, it's we run the gamut in terms of providing information to the public. So we have a great job, and I always say, you know, to get up every day and to know that you can change the lives of the American public is a pretty good way to go.
Thank you very much. That was great. We appreciate it very much. Are there any commissioners that have questions at this point on any particular subject? I did have a couple of questions on for Ms. Bird, and I was interested in the budgeting issues. We don't have a budget per se for our website. Maybe any of you could answer that, but do most of you have a separate website budget, or do you share it? I know there was one comment that some people don't have evaluations in their job description on how they're performing in terms of the website, which is probably so, and we are, you know, beginning the in an era where we need to maybe consider more technical approaches and a better organizational structure. So I'm just wondering if budgeting and that kind of thing.
I can speak to the budget. Yeah. At the EPA, we estimate that we spend around $8 to $12 million. On the web, and that's pretty much distributed across all program offices and regions. the Office of Environmental Information does pay for the infrastructure for the agency, and they pay the hosting costs for the agency. I am responsible for the E300, the capital investment that you have to submit to Office of Management and Budget for that particular aspect of the web. And I would say my budget is about $5 million for the infrastructure, some of the hosting. We pay for comments that come into the web to be answered, frequently asked questions. We pay for web analytics program so that we can look to see what people are asking for and whether they were able to find it, and to use that to continue to improve our site. Trying to think of some of the other things. We pay for basically the EPA.gov, the homepage, in the top 200 pages of the website. And the web content management system that we are getting, that we're migrating to, we are paying for that. So OEI, our office pays for a considerable amount of the funding, but it is distributed across the agency because every office has somebody that actually posts information to the web. They may do it themselves, they may have a contractor. And to address the issue that Lisa brought up, which is really an important comment about the fact that it is collateral right now for people to work on the website. And what we're recognizing is we really need professional web people. We need people that this is their job, and this is their only job, so that they do have the time and the training and the skills to do the good editorial, the content. Plus, we need professional designers on the infrastructure side. So this is something that we would like to see in our agency. We're not there yet, but we would really like to see that.
Mm-hmm. Any other comments? Mr. Hunter?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a quick question for Ms. Doris. You mentioned that you have some contracts available for other government agencies to take a look at. Is there something like that for just very basic information on how to build a web page that is most conducive for public use, sort of like building a web page 101, making it searchable and that sort of thing?
On webcontent.gov, there's a lot of information available. I don't have any contracts in place for use by other agencies on the website. It's the big one we have is for the contact center solutions. But I could give you the names of, you know, even companies that we've used to help do that. The chairman's question about the budget, I mean, we have in our office for USA.gov, we have an infrastructure budget, and then the content side is in a different office all under my office. And I don't remember the exact number, but we probably spend close to $15 million a year on the infrastructure part of, of USA.gov and the Gobierno and web content, because you've got all the security features, you've got the content management system, there's a lot of contractors in place that help us, and we have been doing a lot with contractor support to migrate to the cloud. The other thing that it brought up in the issue is, you know, how many government people do you need versus how many contractor people? I mean, when you need graphic designers, sometimes you only need people for a very short period of time, and we found that if we had companies in place that had a variety of different kinds of resources on it, then we can get them to come in for short periods of time and provide the support that we need when we need it. So,
yeah, I think we do that too. Ms. Walshman?
Yes, I'd just like to address a budget issue as well and talk about what I've seen across the federal sector. And Jonda and Martha are both rare in that they can actually express their web budget. Most organizations, that's usually one of the first questions I ask them, because it's an indicator. It's like, how much do you spend managing your website? And you sort of get a deer in the headlights look. Mm. or you get a number that's all about the marketing communication side or all about the apps development side. So that rift that you see between those two organizations, there's a lot of application development that gets embedded in IT that sometimes people don't express as web budget, but it's actually the development of web applications. So there's a lot of that. There's a lot that comes out of that disconnection, and I would probably offer that most organizations really don't know how much money they spend on the web because they don't understand the FTEs that are supporting the web because that's scattered and it's collateral duty, and they also, their budgeting structures don't take into account that integration that is actually really happening.
Well, I asked the question for the same reason because for me it would be a deer in the headlights reaction too. So it's a nice description.
I should probably amend my estimate because it did not account for all the applications, the IT applications, but it does account for the landing pages that those applications eventually, the interface to the public.
It's possible we don't want to have the big number because because it's very expensive when you add it all up.
I had a question because I know that some people here, and I'm sure Alec will understand, but what do you mean by cloud?
Cloud is basically
exactly?
The internet.
It seems
so,
to be Sack smiling, so I'm sure everybody else knows.
So, for example, in a client-server environment, you have one server and it has one application. You have another server and it has another application. In the virtual environment, you can take one server and put multiple applications on it. So when you read a lot about going from one environment to a virtual environment and the savings that you're getting, mostly you're getting a lot of savings out of the reduction of the footprint from all your servers. So it also allows you to have different applications that run different versions of things. There's a way to partition off the servers in a different way than in the old environment. So when you move from that to the cloud, it's more like it's a virtual environment, and there's different kinds of clouds. There's a public cloud, a private cloud. A public cloud is basically the internet. I mean, everything is out there. It's open. We went to a private cloud, which means you can secure it a little bit easier. Right now, GSA is in the process of creating a storefront for agencies to go on and actually buy services in the cloud through the storefront where it's already secured on the back end and provisioned by just using a credit card or requisition number. But it's just a newer technology that allows you to reduce the footprint.
I see.
There's probably a lot.
I sort of see. I would ask Mr. Palmer if you get any questions as we go along. Please feel free to ask any as we go along, too. Mr. Vice Chairman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Most interested in the comments that we heard regarding knowing your customer. Obviously, investing money into your web presence can be very expensive, as you pointed out, so trying to get the most bang for your buck is vital, and trying to find out what value you can give to your customers, obviously, of paramount importance. And so I was very interested to hear what Ms. Doris had to say about some of the ways in which some of the feedback mechanisms from your customers, you were able to find out what it is that they wanted. And I was wondering if you could maybe give us a few more details and maybe a few more examples of how an organization can better develop ways of understanding what it is their customer wants so that sort of content can be provided to them. And also I'd be interested if Ms. Bird or Ms. Welchman also had some ideas on this whole idea of getting to know your customer better so that we can provide the services that they most demand.
Well, you have a whole range of ways that you can engage with your customer. One would be some of the new public dialogue kind of tools where, I don't know if you've followed any of the Open Government Initiative where they put out a question that's, or the recovery.gov initiative where you put out a question, what tools, ideas, and processes do you have that would help the government, make the information more transparent? And then, so these tools allow the public, or if you target it to your customer, to provide comments. It provides other people the ability to comment on those comments. It allows you to tag those comments and sort of bucket them in buckets so that you don't have to sift through you know, millions of comments, and then it allows them to kind of rate and rank them so that you can come out with the top 10 issues that people might be interested in. So that's one area. You can if you come out with top, you know, your top three issues, you may want to use another kind of tool or the same one to get more information on that specific topic that they've brought up. It's as easy as putting, you know, you could put something on the website that just says, you know, if you have comments on the website, send it to an email address. You could, the usability testing is fascinating. You know, you sit your customers in a room and there's cameras on each computer and they're given scenarios, and then they look for the information that you've asked them to, and they kind of talk through it as they're looking for it, and you can see, well, they don't know that you get a passport from the Department of State, or they don't know that their driver's license is a state, state government feature or service. It's not from the federal government. Oh my God, we asked them to find their driver's license, and everybody went to the Department of Transportation. So all of those things that you kind of watch them, or they say, oh, this search box isn't long enough. I can't get my, you know, my information in it. So that gets you down into the nitty gritty of the actual design of your website. I mean, we're looking at, does the public want to get information on the phone? Do they prefer to do it via the web? How does the public feel about the use of social media? And so we've done it specific to our websites, and now we're looking at it from a government-wide perspective on how to gauge what the citizens want. The other, just reviewing what people search on when they come to your site or what they search on, it's fairly easy to go into even some of the tools that Google offers or go into their site and start searching, and the top search terms come up so you can see, what they're currently coming, and then doing some customer satisfaction and measuring their satisfaction with what you currently provide. To me, would be kind of the gamut of things that you could use to kind of get a feel for what your customers want.
Okay, we use a number of tools too, and I agree there's a range. Everything from having a focus group to listening sessions. I'm going to talk a little bit about our web analytics program that we have established, and then talk about an initiative that we did very quickly. We use the American Customer Satisfaction Index. A lot of the other government agencies do use this. It's a survey on customer satisfaction. We get, in the last 18 months, we've had 34,000 people submit and take the survey. We get about 2,000 people a month that actually provide us comments. And we have a clustering tool that we can take and apply that tool onto these comments. So if we're interested in a particular hot topic, we can go in and look at the comments that we received, apply that clustering tool on the comments, and then come up with all of the comments just on that. And then we can also see the questions that they answered and how they rated us on the different questions within the survey. It's a very powerful tool. And that's basically opinions.
Basically what?
Opinions. It's basically getting opinions from people. And you also have the ability to come up with questions, that open-ended questions that you want to ask them. And we're in the process of revising some of those. We also have a tool that helps us with the traffic. You know, where did they come from? Where did they go? We don't have the ability to actually follow their path because we don't have persistent cookies, but we are able to see the traffic for the various websites and pages, so that helps us. So looking at those things together really gives you a picture.
I have a question. Do you ever look to how people get to you?
Yes, we do. We look at the referrers, like, you know, mm-hmm. how many came from Google, how many came from Inside EPA, which is a lot of them, how many came from other government agencies. But we do know the referrers of the site, so how they came to us.
Do you know the question they ask? I mean, people type in a question,
we
learned, I think, to our surprise, that most of the people that come to us don't come to us through our website.
Right. Yes, we do know that,
don't we? So then
That's true for commercial sites,
too. Question they ask, and then it comes to us.
Most of the people come to us from Google, and they don't come through EPA.gov. They go straight into a page that they found on Google. So that's how they come to us. We have also have this other thing that we do, and it's something called Crazy Egg, where we put a heat map on a page, and we can see how many clicks different items on the page get, so that we can see what is being looked at and what's not. And that's been very valuable, and it also gives us referring information. We review search logs all the time. We have monthly reports that gives us the top 10 search phrases or terms, and they are pretty consistent. And we also look at trends and see over a period of a years, you know, how we're trending. In 2008, we established the National Dialogue with the public and with stakeholders, other government agencies, to talk about information access and how we can improve information access. We've got valuable input. We did a variety of just something very simple of having a comments database where people could go in. We did blogs. We did jam sessions where we did blogs where we said, okay, we're blogging right now. You know, we'll answer your question if you submit something right now. So those were very valuable. We also had listening sessions, and from that we came up with an access strategy and what our goals and what are important. And our goals are similar to GSA. It's to be able to find accurate, timely information. People also wanted more information on data. And so we are developing a data finder, or have developed a data finder. They also wanted more raw data published, so we're looking at that. They were still very interested in making sure we met the digital divide, making sure that people that didn't have web access had access to information. And they also wanted to connect better to the EPA. So in that, they really wanted to be able to talk to an expert. They didn't want to have to go through some of these other forums. The other thing, every web page has to have a contact us button so that they have to take comments. Many of us use a system called an enterprise customer service solution, where you can go in and actually put a comment in, ask a question, but it also gives you frequently asked questions that have already been addressed, and so that you can go in and search that by topic, and oftentimes your question has already been answered. That has really reduced our labor in answering questions by deploying that.
I'll just say briefly, because these two set me up perfectly, when I think about measuring effectiveness in a web presence, it's three pieces, one of which is usability, which Martha talked about extensively, and the other one is analytics, the actual behavior of what's going on. But I would just say, as a caveat, I believe that it's important to pay attention to what the public's asking for and what they're demanding. But it's also important to have another bookend on the side of that bookshelf, which is, what are you trying to do and what's your mission? Because a lot of times people will define success as, we got a lot of hits, or they really liked it, or we got a lot of comments. But were you actually able to translate that? And, you know, so really understanding what your performance indicators are, what are you trying to do, and when do you know when you're going to succeed, will keep you from just pushing and pushing and pushing technology and all sorts of things kind of willy-nilly. That's a challenge, because, you know, I'm trying to write a paper on what are web performance indicators, and it's not as simple as I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be really simple, but figuring out what those are, and I think the manifestation of that will be different for every organization, but I think it's really important for you to know what success looks like, so you know when you've gotten there. Otherwise, you'll just kind of be, it'll be like the last 15 years all over again, where everybody's doing everything and not really knowing if you're getting anything done.
I'm going to tie one thing together. Well, it's a lot of pieces, but we created a thing called the Innovations Council. And what was happening was, you know, I'd see some cool idea, and our content team would see some cool idea, and somebody else would, and we were constantly going to our infrastructure guys and saying, you know, we want this, we want this, we want this. And there was no way for them to prioritize what they needed to do. And so we created the Innovations Council so that ideas can be brought to the group. We can decide at that point, is it worth spending any of our resources to go forward with that idea or not? Or based on, and it ties a bunch of this together, what are you trying to achieve? How does it affect our measures? Because we were parted about 3 years ago. We do measure touch points. We measure cost per touch point. We measured the customer satisfaction index, so that when somebody wants to do something and they have no information about, is it going to increase our touch points or how does it affect our measures? Some things are good government. Some things are, we're piloting something. We want to test it and see what it's like. But this allows a group of people across our whole office to say yes or no and all agree that that's a priority, so that if that's a priority by the group, this other thing is not a priority and we all have agreed to it together. Because, you know, that whole content infrastructure, you know, flare-ups all the time, that was one of the ways that we've worked together, and it just proceeds through some gateways on, you know, the progress of the programs and the projects, even features, you know, that we're in the middle of doing a content management migration and somebody wants to do a photo contest. Well, what is more important? So we bring it to that Innovations Council.
Thank you, Mr. Barley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you for sharing your expertise with us, particularly Ms. Bird and Ms. Doris, with respect to your experience in significantly larger agencies. But I think we have a lot to learn, and you know, scalability, I guess, is key. Can we, you know, bring things down to our level? You know, a 46-person council is not something that we may see, but I actually think that the idea of putting together in a formal and structured way the content and the IT people, something that I think is happening across our agency on a daily, hourly basis, so that consultation and communication is happening. But I think the structure that you described in the Web Council and Ms. Doris in the Innovation Council that you just described, I think would be very helpful for how we move all of this forward. Our IT folks and our communications folks, you know, do this on a daily basis and lots of projects and plans, and I think that maybe adding that layer of structure and governance, as you've been talking about, Ms. Welshman, would be very helpful. I guess I don't really have a comment. I really just wanted to thank you and make one note. I really appreciated your final point, Ms. Welshman, that we probably have lots of really good ideas within our agency, and I think bringing some structure to this process, and I think these hearings are a good way to start that, to bring some structure to this and create a formalized mechanism where that input and feedback and the idea generation can be fully integrated into what we're doing. I know we've got some great professionals on this already. I think based on what we heard at the last session of this hearing, people have appreciated the improvements that we've made, and I think everyone's interested in doing more. So I look forward to moving forward, and I appreciate your thoughts on how to help us structure that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. I certainly echo that. I know all of us do. We have about 5 minutes left. Are there any other questions that the commissioners may want to ask? Mr. Palmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had a couple quick questions. The first one is for Ms. Bird, and again, thank you for all of you being here today. Can you briefly share with us on your web content management system, if you could, some of the methodology, the process that you went through in making that selection, and if possible, share with us maybe not too much the pain of that process, but the success of that process, and could you even share with us what your selection was and why, if that's possible?
This is really interesting, and Lisa's laughing because she knows the process we went through for this, and it was not a good one. When you select a platform, typically you go out and you do systems requirements. You listen to the people that are going to need the system and use the system and put in the requirements, and you do an analysis and an evaluation and an assessment, and then you bring in the products and you maybe test drive them. We did none of that. Our agency had done that for a document content management system. The document management system that they selected had a web content management component. So at the same time that this other group within the Office of Environmental Information was beginning to develop their content, enterprise content management system to address a lot of the docket records management issues. We put in a proposal for a web content management system, and it was decided at the highest level within our organization that we would combine our proposal. We would have one system, and that's how we got the system that we have. Now, that has been an issue, and I don't recommend you do it that way. And we have made the platform work. We went into it with a we're going to test this to see if it will work. Not we're going to hope this fails, but you know we really had to go into it with an attitude that we're going to make this work. And so it is Documentum. Fortunately, Documentum has upgraded the system, and with the latest service pack, we have gotten improved functionality. We've also worked with some smaller vendors that have had to deal with the difficult interface and had already developed a good product that we could then adopt. So not quite the process that we should have done, but we are where we are.
Well, thank you for your advice. my second to last question is for Ms. Doris. You talked a bit about the cloud process, and I just wanted to validate. Did you go through a virtualization process first before you moved to the cloud, or did you just make the leap?
We actually went out for a virtual with a virtual requirement, and they bid a cloud environment. So we did not. We did it all at one time.
And you mentioned it's a private cloud. Mm-hmm. Who's that with?
Terramark.
Okay. Now, did you have any hurdles to overcome with your security officers and your privacy people in order to do that, and how did you do that?
Actually, this system, because it's a private cloud, it has been tested to the NSA level. So security-wise, we're in good shape with where we are. The problem is, you know, you hear about the server huggers. That's a true issue. People like to have servers, you know, the technologists like to have them in their office, under their desk, at their house, whatever. They don't like to give up that kind of control. So we went through a lot of steps to try to get them more comfortable with going into a virtual environment, brought other agencies in that had already done it. The contractor we were using brought up, I mean, we went through a long process. And you know, they're 90% there, but they're still, you know, having shakes from giving up their servers. The content management question, we had a hellish process years ago, and we just picked a new content management system. And part of the problem that we had with the first one was it was highly customized. And so it took us years and years to get the content management system in. The process, and I can share that with you. We have a documented way. We started with like 100. We looked at the requirements. We wanted to be as off the shelf as possible, and the way that it was downscaled, and then we went through, you know, some on-site testing. I forget how they did it, and then picked one and went out and used the resellers in order to buy that. And we bought Percussion, and it looks like it's going to be implemented in about 3 months' time, which is amazing in comparison to the process that we went through before. So I'd be glad to share all that work with you, because they did a really nice job on going through at least the selection process. We're not migrated yet, but yeah.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Well, yeah, excuse me. Ms. Duncan?
Thank you.
General Counsel.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Wanted to thank the panel as well. I think you've provided us with a great deal of helpful and, importantly, practical information, so thank you very much. I was very intrigued by the discussion of a web governance model and that notion as it might apply here at the Commission, and in particular very interested in Ms. Bird's description of the Web Council. One thing that I wondered, a question that I had, is about the decision-making model on that Web Council, because I could imagine that that structure is helpful, but it might present its own challenges. Is it consensus decision-making? Is there a hierarchy? How do you manage that process?
It is consensus. And One of the things, when I said you need to go back and review the charge memos, we've done that in, this year. We've also looked at the charter again this year to see what we really were charged with. And it actually, in the memo, did say a consensus body. We have evolved to sort of an informal voting, but if somebody does vote no, because we've gone to a webinar that actually you can vote online, and then we know. But if somebody votes no, then we go back and we talk to them and see if they can live with it. So, you know, basically we, you know, sometimes sit in a room and say, okay, not everybody's really on board, but can you live with it? And we go forward. So it's not, maybe that's not easy either with 46 people. But we have been able to make some good decisions.
Yes, please. I'll just say briefly, just because we structure a lot of these models, there's a lot of different ways you can do it, and it's very specific to the organization. It has a lot to do with the culture and how you make other decisions. So frequently it's good to look at how you make other decisions, because that one's probably going to go down a little easier unless it's really doesn't make a lot of sense. We've seen lots of different styles. Obviously, the EPA style is challenging with that size, and it can be very, very slow, and there's a lot of, you know, investment that people have to make in moving people's positions. We've also seen the very serious, there's a lot of input. There's cross-functional, cross-team input in the various standards-making or policy-making bodies, and then there's one individual who has the final say-so in terms of making the decision. And when that works in a command and control environment, right, where you can do that sort of thing. And then most people end in between somewhere. We've had models where there are various, particularly at the standards creation level, where there's cross-functional input. And I can't stress that that's really important. That keeps people from being upset when you make the decision, right? You get cross-functional input from people. And then there's a team of four, one very technical, one very editorial, one who's applications and infrastructure tool oriented, and one who's like business process oriented. There's a team of four, and they as a group make the decision on what the various standards are. So there's a lot of creative ways that you can do it, but I would just stress, it's got to be clear. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you'll just keep making this choice over and over again every time you have to do something. So,
yeah, that's very valuable advice. We do have to close now. I want to thank you again on behalf of all of us, how much we appreciate the time you took to come here and help us out with our own development and maturity in terms of beginning to look at new ways to govern ourselves in this process. So it's your wisdom and your experience has been very helpful, and I know it'll probably save us a lot of time and energy and improve our efficiency. I certainly hope so. But again, thank you very much on behalf of all of us. It was very helpful. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll adjourn for a few minutes and take up the panel number two.